There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. All right, we've got an interesting show lined up for you tonight. Joining us, it's been, I think, a little over a year since this guest has been with us. Gare Allen is here. He's the author of the best-selling The Dead, A True Paranormal Story. He is the author of the best-selling First Impression, True Tales from the Road, and he's the author of best-selling seven novellas, and he's here with us again tonight. We're going to talk about his new book, Ghost Crimes, and I knew a lot of people would be interested in this, Gare, when I saw it, and I love the fact that what you've done is you've taken real cases that you're familiar with and cases that police officers have reported to you and woven them into kind of a novel narrative of these different cases. For people that are new and have not heard you on our show, let's get a little bit of background on you, Gare, and welcome back to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, David. It's great to be back again. So I was born and raised, and I still reside in Tampa, Florida. I spent many of my professional life in the pet industry. As such, I'd always been an animal lover, so I've been a very strong advocate of animal welfare. I'm on my second generation of rescue dogs in my home right now, so big supporter of that. I actually wrote a book called The Dogs of Lost Angels and donated all the proceeds for that to a local rescue group here in Tampa so they could continue to help rescue dogs. I've started writing when I was in high school. I took a lot of writing classes in college. I self-published my first short story in 2014. Since then, I've written 13 books. And I'm currently working on making one of my short stories a screenplay. So that's where I'm at today. I just recently released Ghost Crimes. Like you said, we're based on true paranormal and actual cases. And I'm just super excited. So thanks again for having me on.
Well, I want to find out, Garrett, when you're talking about, you know, kind of police investigations, police work, and law enforcement, how did you start collecting stories like that? What was your in?
So what was interesting is, first of all, I've had many, many paranormal experiences, but they've always been, they haven't been egregious. They've been almost playful, and I think a lot of people have those experiences. They experience touching, or they hear sounds or knocks on the window or things like that, and you're like, okay, they're trying to get my attention, but it's nothing, you know, harmful or anything like that. But then those things do happen, and I was grateful they didn't happen to me, but I wondered about those things that happen and why we didn't see more of that, you know, reported, and why it wasn't talked about. And so a good friend of mine who's a police officer, I asked him, I said, hey, how does this work? When you run into these situations where things can't be explained. It may not always be a ghost, but there's something that is left to the imagination, or someone says, hey, you know, something happened paranormal. How do you handle that? And I spoke with about four or five other of his peers, and they all said the same thing. Absolutely, it happens all the time. And I'm like, just, you know, start telling me stories. You know, what has happened? And so they would tell me what happened, and I used a lot of that in the book, but they wouldn't necessarily report it. No, because, well, it, back in the day, today it's a little different, but back in the day, some of the older detectives And officers I spoke with, you know, you didn't want to become a Mulder. You didn't want to be that guy, you know, that talked about craziness and got shunned by the rest of the office. So you just sort of kept it to yourself. And but now more these days, they actually do talk about it a little bit. But they can't say that if somebody, a great example is people that have, you know, the three scratches on their back or on their stomach and they're perfectly aligned, like a three-pronged fork had just perfectly made this, you know, three incisions. And it just appeared, you know, overnight. And, you know, they look to domestic abuse or self-mutilation, and that's more plausible than a ghost or a demon or something haunting them. So they go that route. But what I did learn was interesting is all the case files that had a paranormal element, there is something that denotes it in the file. So the case files are different per precinct, actually, believe it or not. So there's no standardized case file creation of those of that number, but each number represents, it can represent the city, the precinct, the type of crime, but there is a number, and at the precinct that I got most of my information, 10 denoted a paranormal element, which I thought was very interesting. So they would right. say, yes, there was something going on, but then they kind of, they didn't get too detailed for fear of ridicule.
Well, now, and I've talked to quite a few police officers through the years, and many of them have kind of this innate sixth sense. I think that's what makes a good police officer a great police officer, right? They kind of pick up on when people are bad, when people are about to do something horrific, and it's ways to keep themselves safe as well, that kind of spidey sense that's triggered. And I've talked to a lot of these police officers who get called on strange calls they think are breaking and entering or trespassing charges. They get there to find absolutely nothing there, and then they begin to experience it as well. They'll start hearing the footsteps running through the attic or in the basement. And it's been interesting because, again, kind of like you said, nobody wants to be spooky Mulder from X-Files. Nobody wants to come out and be the one talking about it openly. But they all seem to have... I shouldn't say all, but there is a good portion of law enforcement officials and police officers that have encountered what can only kind of be described as supernatural occurrences. When they were telling you about this, when they got past the BS to find out, okay, this wasn't just an abusive husband or abusive wife trying to disguise, you know, the violence under the guise of supernatural activity. Once they got past that and started to realize that what they were facing really seemed otherworldly and did not have a natural rational explanation, would they tell you how they would go about handling that? I mean, would they refer people to psychics, mediums, witch doctors, or would they do something personally themselves, or did they just have to walk away from those situations?
So they would do one of two things is the response I got. One was that they would refer them to an unofficial source for that department, that somebody would go in and cleanse the home or, you know, and help them out, a psychic, a medium, and go in there and help these folks out. So, yeah, there was an unofficial person that they would refer them to or get them in contact with. And then they would very much wash their hands of it after that point. So,
boy, talk about a sticky situation to be a police officer. Right? To be a police officer and then trying to help somebody and then referring them to a medium or a psychic. And in most cases, they charge for some of their services. That's got to be a sticky situation too, because if you feel that there's any kind of fraud going on with these mediums or psychics, it's, you know, police officers are putting themselves in the line of danger because they're referring these people to them, and those are the same people they may have to investigate for fraud in the future.
Exactly. So they, like I said, they would wash their hands of it for that very reason, among others, and say, okay, you know, this is where we're at, and they would just document the facts. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, is when they investigate, even though they may experience some things they can't explain, they look for the facts, and that's what they're taught, and that's where they're going to be most effective, is don't get caught up in the emotion or, you know, or the circus of the events that are happening. Focus on the facts. And draw a conclusion from there. And especially with those who have seen horrific murders and things like that, they tell them that you have to remove yourself from the emotion. You have to be completely objective and be black and white. Also, they would refer them to a church, and there were some police officers that had very strong faiths, and they would bring them to their church. So they were a little more involved, because they would bring those folks to their church and get them in touch with them so that they could work that angle. And sometimes the folks in the church would come out and bless the house and help them out in that respect.
Have you run in? I've talked to a few police officers who have felt that they were in over their head when it came to that, you know, aspects of the supernatural, and weren't confident referring them on to somebody because they really weren't in the know of who to refer them to. And in one case, I know a police officer, I've got to be very careful here, who...
I know.
right. I know a police officer who was physically thrown by something unseen while at the investigation. And we did a story in our Theater of the Mind, oh boy, I think about 6-7 months ago, regarding a couple of police officers that were called to what they thought was a domestic and turned out to be what they believe was a full-on possession. And they, you know, they gave me the story, shared their tale, and then off the record said, this was, you know, how do you report this? How do you take this in without making yourself look like a lunatic, but trying to explain exactly the details, just the facts? Even when you're laying out the facts, it can make you look like you're nuts. And it was a very hard case for them to deal with because, you know, there are so many elements of what was going on that it was torture for them to deal with that kind of case.
Sure. And I think the most chilling and story I got was one of the officers had gone to a house, and it was on a couple acres, and they had a small barn behind them, and they had like one cow or something like that. They just lived a rural life, and it was very cold in the barn, and it's Florida. It's always hot. But in these cases that I wrote about all take place here in Florida, and it was summer and it was just extremely cold in the barn. And they said, it doesn't get warm in here. It never gets warm in here. And, he got him in touch with, you know, the unofficial psychic or medium. And when he got home, his, 4-year-old son came out of the room and was crying and holding him. And, the older sister came out and said, he said, what's going on? And she said, well, the man won't stop yelling at us. And he's like, what man? And he's like, he keeps saying for you, he said, tell your daddy to stay out of the barn. And what happened was that something had gotten to his children. So of course that warning just devastated him. That number one, he was in a weird situation, but he came home and something had, you know, upset his children and actually entered his home to say that and have them repeat that. And it was just terrifying, you know, for a father to hear that, you know, that his children were upset by something like that. So, you know, I think that's what the worst part for these folks that investigate this is, they follow them home or they do something to their family as a warning to stay away, which tells us that they see them as a threat. They're investigating what's going on and they're saying, hey, we're going to keep doing this, back off. And there's another dilemma for these poor officers. You know, these folks, these officers, detectives, these firefighters, these military, these folks that literally just leave their home and say, I'm going to put my life on the line today for complete strangers because that's who I am and that's my job. And we don't think about what they deal with, you know, the paranormal and all the other things and the dangers. And, you know, there's this, we're starting to have a lot more respect for them as a country, and we should have just so much more, I think, for what they have to deal with.
I know in the book you kind of start off with your own experience. Would you mind, Gare, walking us through what that experience was, detailed?
Sure. So when I was very young, I think it was second grade, there was a family that lived down the street. And, you know, I think the children are always, you know, they always know what's going on in the neighborhood. They hear everything. They see everything. You know, they pick up everything on the peripheral. And this family had two daughters and a young son. And two or three nights a week, the kids would be screaming, running down the street. And we were on a very quiet cul-de-sac, you know, upper middle class neighborhood, very quiet. And it would always cause a ruckus. And we never knew what was going on until one night we decided to stay up late. And we were spending the night, you know, across the street at a friend's house. And so when the kids came running out, we ran over to their house and we found the mother with a very long kitchen knife just chasing them down the street after them. And it was just a horrific scene to see at that age, a mother chasing children with a knife in the middle of the night. And, you know, the street lights, you know, glistening off the knife. And it was like, whoa. And I think not even a week later, I'm walking home from school, and the youngest boy was just standing in the front yard holding a bird, a little parakeet, and with a knife sticking out of it. And he's just crying and crying and crying. And the police showed up immediately. In fact, they actually just drove right by me to get in the driveway. And you could hear the husband explaining what had happened. And he was explaining that the mother had heard voices, and they came through the vents in the house, and he would move her from room to room to so she couldn't hear the voices telling her to do these things. And again, you know, when you're young, time is weird, but I think it was just a few days later that the police arrived, and I got this information from the adults, that they showed up, and the father had tied the mother to a chair, her arms and her legs, and they had tied her to a chair because she was out of control physically. And he did that so that he could call the police then to come and help her, but he had to restrain her so she wouldn't harm, you know, the children. And when the police arrived, they described a woman with red hair, with red eyes, you know, spitting at them and snarling at them. Like, they said she was possessed, that she was screaming. The room she was in was freezing cold. I believe it was May was the month, which is, you know, just sticky and hot here. And all the lights were off in the house, you know, so they were using flashlights. And when they got the power back on and it was over, the woman had blonde hair and blue eyes and was just completely passed out. And the officers swore up and down, you know, that that wasn't the case. That's not what they saw. And after that, they took the mother to an institution.
How terrifying.
Yeah.
Right. What a change. But it was such like a, was this an overnight kind of thing, or was this a slow, steady burn? Like, you believe that there might have been a real psychological issue as opposed to a possession.
You know, there was an issue with the previous family that I wasn't privy to, and I'm still digging, because there was something going on in that home prior to that. But I was in the second grade, and we'd actually just moved there, and then they moved in very shortly after. But it all happened in a very short period of time, and the adults I talked to, who some of them still live on the street that I grew up on, I said, how long did they live in that house? And they said 3 months was their guess. So all of this did happen in a very short period of time.
And had anybody else ever kind of talked about the supernatural aspects in their life as part of that family, or anything that happened after that?
So the neighbors didn't, but the police that I talked to actually found remnants of, and of course in Florida we have, you know, very small attics, and remnants of what they considered voodoo. The more information I got, I think it was more Santeria. You know, I guess there's a fine line between the two, but they're, you know, both pretty scary. So they found elements of those, including a pentagram carved into the top of the ceiling in the attic. And the room in which she was tied in and became possessed was right below that part of the attic. So in talking to these officers, a pentagram figures prominently in many of their stories. And
isn't that weird?
You know, in my experience, and I know a pentagram is used for protection. You know, a lot of Wiccans, other folks will use it for protection.
Right. I think it's the pentacle. Isn't it the pentacle that's a bad thing? Or I always get him confused. One of them is a star upright. The other is the upside down star. One is a pentagram. One is a pentacle. And I can never keep the two straight in my head.
You're absolutely right, and I believe the upside down is the pentacle. And it was funny when I was when I sent out my first drafts to my beta readers, and actually one of your previous guests, Joni Mahan, she had pointed that out to me. She's like, "Be careful with this." And so I said, "I'm going to call it a five-pointed star."
Right.
Yeah, let's just make this easy, because it's used for so many different things. But when it's turned upside down, the idea is that it's bringing down, it's bringing things in, as opposed to protecting and pushing, you know, white light up and away and protecting you. So I noticed that the pentagram is often on a Ouija board. And so in many of the stories, I said, "Hey, did you ever see a Ouija board in the house?" And one of the officers looked at me and he goes, "They had it on their coffee table. How did you know that?" And I just thought that of, you know, it's a toy, you know, in air quotes here, it's a toy, but a lot of times it'll have that pentagram on there, and if it's drawn a certain way, it's almost like a doorway that it can open up and allow things through, and that's how they get through. And I thought that was very interesting. So I incorporated that into the stories as well. But the more I asked, the more I found out that there was either a Ouija board with a pentagram or a pentacle, or there was one drawn somewhere or carved into the wood. And that's an opening doorway right there. You just let things in, and that's pretty scary. So anybody wandering by, it's like leaving your front door open. You know, it's like anybody can just wander in and out. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's no doubt. Interesting stuff. And when you decide you're going to set out and write this book, start sharing some of these stories that police officers have shared with you over the years, and kind of weave them into a narrative on this. Were there stories that police officers told you, you know, here's what happened, but I don't ever want you to talk about it, write about it, speak about it, don't even remember this story?
Sure. And of course, my response is, why did you tell me?
Right.
Because you're killing me here. You know, I'm a writer. I want the good stuff. But sadly, they would usually have some sort of severe abuse, sexual abuse of small children, and things that I'm not even sure I could write about. It makes me so uncomfortable just to even say the words. So there were definitely those situations where it was like, no, that doesn't need to happen. I did hear one story, and I toyed around with putting it in the book, and I didn't. But it was a woman who was pregnant, and she there was an altercation at the house, and the house, when the officer walked in, was completely freezing. And she was 8 months pregnant, but then she immediately went into labor, just right then and there. And the officer had to deliver the baby, and he swears on a stack of Bibles and his life that when the baby came out, there was a 666 on the forehead. And when it got to the hospital, it wasn't there. There was no sign of it. There was no sign of any scarring, but he swears up and down. He's like, trust me, I was coherent. I was delivering a baby, which I've never done in my life. He's like, why would I make this up? The guy has no other stories, no other claims. He didn't want me to tell anybody. You know, he's like, no, it didn't happen. Don't use it. And I'm like, I won't put it in my book. He's like, okay. So he just shared it with me because I asked. But, you know, there it was. And then he had no reason, you know, to do that. And he wasn't comfortable telling me about it. It wasn't a pleasant experience. He was worried that if he didn't deliver the baby properly, it could pass. You know, so he was terrified at what he was having to do. And, again, going back to what these folks do in their positions, you know, I don't think
right.
we have any clue what they go through to help strangers. You know, they really just deserve so much credit and accolades.
How many stories have you collected, and for over what period of time have you been collecting these different tales?
I collected them, oh gosh, it was well over a year that I did it, and then I narrowed it down to six. And I broke it into six almost short stories, but there's a thread through them that connects them. So they can be read alone, but there's a thread between all six of them.
I'm curious, too, as an author, collecting these stories and starting to put, you know, pen to paper, if you will, and sharing them, does that open any kind of weird experiences for you?
You know, it's interesting. I worry about that because, you know, once you open your thoughts to that, you wonder if something's going to happen. So did I have some experiences in that time? You know, sure. But they weren't egregious. They weren't crazy. I think the worst was I was lying on my side, and I was in a really weird mood. I was very agitated, and I was trying to get to sleep, but I wasn't sleepy, but I knew I had to go to bed. And it was one of those nights. And so I'm lying on my side, and I have my shirt off, and I feel two fingers just touch my ribs and push me so much that my body rocks. And I flipped out, you know, because number one, I've always believed that the bedroom is like, you know, the most sacred place, especially it's just your safe space. You sleep there. You're the most vulnerable there. So, you know, you go to a friend's house, you don't even go in their bedroom. It's one of the
right.
places you don't go in the room, you know. It's like, that's you know, no, we don't, that's off limits. So that really scared me. I didn't like that. But a lot of knockings. And so in my home, I bought my home in 99, and I didn't know that the former owner had killed himself in the house. So to this day, I have a lot of things happen, but it's only when there's changes. Like I put up Christmas decorations, or if I remodel a room, they don't like, or he doesn't like that. He does not like that I'm changing things, and the activity will increase. But if I keep everything status quo, there's not a lot going on. But I did have a few nightmares that were related to the stories. So that's a little tough because it's in my subconscious, it's in my mind. You know, I stay up late writing and then I go to sleep and I think my mind keeps writing. So I'm not going to say that I was visited in my dreams, you know, but I definitely had nightmares as a result of some of them for sure.
I love, you know, when you're able to kind of tie what we consider the strange element of the paranormal and you start to tie it to individuals who are paid and known to be professional observers, right? And witnesses and looking for details that others might miss. And when police officers get called in, do they have many of them told you they get called into a thing thinking it's normal? Even the family thinks it's normal. And it isn't until they're on site that all of them realize that it's something supernatural. Or do most of the time, do the police officers flip it around and they find legitimate or logical answers for these weird experiences?
Well, I think it's a lot of it's their nature in that they're looking for the facts. So the, you know, hardcore facts don't generally include ghosts. So they're, it's kind of not on their radar yet. But once they eliminate the things that they're looking for, now they're open to that second possibility. Some are more open than others. Some are very resistant because of just a fear of the paranormal or their faith and they don't believe in it. And then there's, of course, there's one or two that everything's a ghost, everything's paranormal, you know, no matter what. So you have a couple different kinds of folks these days that are on the force, but they do try to debunk. And I think that's very widespread in our culture now. You know, there's a lot of our ghost shows, you know, we always try to debunk first. That's the first thing we do. Then we can kind of open our minds to, okay, we've removed the elements and et cetera. So now let's see what's left that we can, you know, find out how and why these things are happening. And I said before, they have to remain not emotional. They drove that point home to me because it's very difficult to investigate crimes, especially where someone is injured or hurt or threatened or, you know, you feel uncomfortable. I mean, some of them said they walk into a house and they knew right away that there was bad mojo was the term they would use. And they would find substance abuse was common in the house or, you know, that's often the case. And if you read up on that, you know, excessive drinking or drug use will open your aura to the negativity and bring them in. You invite them in the home and things like that. And so if they feel that immediately, they kind of go on guard. But, you know, their big concern was when they left, that, you know, something would follow them home. And some of them actually had some rituals where they stopped by their church on the way home and asked, you know, to be blessed or use some holy water, you know, or just prayed. You know, they say a silent prayer before they go home so they don't bring those things with them. So it's whether or not they 100% believe in it, they believe in it enough to protect themselves. And thank God for that.
Right. Yeah. Did when you're hearing from these officers as well, I'm just curious, is there one group of, you know, how do I say this? I know it seems racially insensitive, but are there different ethnicities that are more likely to believe in the paranormal if you speak to an African-American police officer as opposed to a Hispanic officer, as opposed to a Caucasian or Asian? Do they all deal with the paranormal in different ways, you know, belief systems, so on? Will they all go headlong in to try to help, or are there certain races you found that just want nothing to do with it?
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that because I did talk to a lot of different kind of people. With different backgrounds and different attitudes and, you know, and some of them are like, you know, bring on the ghosts. I'll battle them all day long because they're so dedicated to their cause. And others are like, yeah, I don't really want to deal with that. I'm going to look for the, I'll go find the fingerprints and the clues. You guys handle the ghosts. But I will say that the women were definitely more open to it, to the existence, the opportunity for that they did exist. They were like, yeah, you know, they definitely see it. And I don't know if the guys more so just didn't want to admit it as much, but once one guy would admit it, then the others would follow suit, and I'd start to get a little more truth out of them once they broke down that barrier. But the there was a Hispanic individual, and you know, there's Santeria and there's voodoo. You know, every culture's got their magic, and those things, you know, bring in the spirits and invite them in, and that's what they see that is when you're doing using those things, or you're praying to the wrong god, so to speak. So you bring those things in. So they were more scared of the faith, I guess, than anything, what the family practiced or believed. But no, I mean, I can't say really one was more than the other, than the women were definitely more open to, you know, the possibility right out of the gate, whereas the guys tend to be more, you know, left brain and analytical.
Interesting. Well, pretty much the way we find most of our listeners in that same sense. Not saying that, again, men are shut off to that, but the women do seem, I guess women's intuition is a very real thing, right? A lot of women are just more in touch with that aspect of reality, or their reality, and it seems that they're a little bit more willing to open to that type of experience.
Sure. And you know, and not to go back to talk like a caveman here, but, you know, guys are protectors by nature, and women are too, don't get me wrong, but we are, that's been ingrained in us for very many, many years that we're the protectors. So if like you said earlier, if our spidey senses go off, we are on alert. I mean, we're fists up, we're, you know, going to take care of this. So if we sense something, you know, the defenses go up, but we want something real, you know, show me what I need to hit. Show me what I need to knock down. Show me what I need to remove. You know, I want to see it. I want to feel it. I want to, you know, it needs to be real so we can tackle it, so to speak. And that's how we go with things. So we look at it, you know, on that base level, which is physical. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I had, you know, kind of following in that same vein, I had an officer out of Arizona, and I won't get specific to the town, because, again, I'm sure this is not something he wanted to talk with me about. He wanted to talk with me about, but I'm not sure he wants me to air it and out him in the story. But he was called, they were called to a domestic dispute, and he and his partner showed up. And they could hear yelling and screaming, and they were trying to get in because nobody was responding, but they could tell that somebody inside the house was being beaten up on. They were able to finally gain entry. And this officer, and the reason I was asking what the belief system was, really, really nice guy, great guy that I know, African-American. And he said he walked into that room and saw this kid being flung around like a rag doll, screaming for help. And he said, I just looked, shook my head, and walked out of the room because I my brain could not function. I could not conceive of what I was seeing. And I just couldn't be. His partner ended up tackling the kid and trying to hold the kid to the ground. And he was being dragged around a bit. But he said it was just so unnerving for him to walk in, have the mother huddled in a corner and her kid just being literally batted around the room like a ping pong ball. And he said, what do I do in that situation? There is no amount of training you can give to that. And I found that a lot of my black, and I hate saying African American because that just seems so, but a lot of my black friends that are involved in the supernatural or have faith, they're very faith detailed. And, you know, deeply religious or Christian in a lot of sense. And when they've seen things or experienced the paranormal, they said it's a real paradigm shift. It's not so much that they're terrified. You know, TV likes to make the black culture look like they're, you know, nervous Nellies about all of this. And, you know, as we've seen with the Ghost Bros and other people on TV, that's not necessarily the case. But, you know, you can highlight any aspect of that. But they're certainly a lot more vocal and impacted by it, because that just is not something that we're supposed to see. And I thought that was just fascinating aspects of what he was telling me is, you know, as somebody who's dedicated his life to protecting and serving, and he said, I'll tell you, Dave, I'm the first one, I would dive in front of a bullet for a kid. But when you walk into a room, the mother's screaming and hunched down in the corner covering her head while her kid is being batted around the room by an invisible force, there's nothing in your world that prepares you to know what to do next.
Wow. Yeah, and you brought up an interesting point. You know, him and his partner showed up, and that was something I found out, that when there was one person responding to a call, there was a lot of, you know, hemming and hawing on details and, you know, not reporting any kind of paranormal experience. But when there was two, and somebody, and they would say, did you see what I saw? You know, tell me your version, you know, before we report this, you know, are we on the same page? And, you know, then you would get a lot more information. And I interviewed two people that were partners at one time, and, you know, it was like a tennis match. I was just watching them go back and forth, you know, telling the story and finishing each other's sentences. And it's interesting, you know, because that's traumatic. That's serious, you know, trauma to witness something like that. And, you know, I guess like going to war or something, everybody comes back a little bit different from it and how they react to it. You know, your brain has to make sense of it and has nothing to there's no category for that. There's no lexicon to pull from to say this is that, you know, especially if it's something you never considered could exist. And, you know, to have that child element, you know, when the officers were talking about the involvement of children, you didn't have a dry eye talking to me, and their heads would go down, and they would shuffle their feet, and you could tell it just broke their heart. It devastated them that there would be a child involved in any crime, you know, but especially, you know, these paranormal ones where there was harm involved. And you're helpless to help a helpless child. That feeling just must be, yeah. How do you reconcile that? Your job is to help them, and you have no idea how to do it. You know, like you said,
exactly.
There was no training for that.
Yeah, your father's beating on a kid. You take him out, taser him, knock him to the ground, handcuff him. That's something we can all physically do. Well, not all of us. Let me just say that. But I mean, that's something tangible that at least you can feel like I can enter this fray and have a fighting chance. But what do? Do you just start swinging at the air? Do you pepper spray the air in hopes that it's going to affect the spirits or the energy? I don't know. You know, I can't even begin to, you know, you listen to cops and they'll tell you, even in the stuff that they do in regular law, they're just not prepared. When you walk into a massacre or a suicide and things like that, you've heard about it, you've studied, you've seen film, but it's a totally different thing to walk in on it. And I can't even imagine then what it's like to have to face something supernatural. Because again, how do you know, what's your point then to the law? And I love like the story of the Enfield poltergeist case in England, where, you know, what's intriguing with that story and stories like the, what is the name of it? The Smurl haunting that took place, that had police involved. They knew that things were going on. They would be called to houses here. People would hear them screaming and yelling, and they'd get to the house and there was nobody home. And they, you know, this became regular for them. You know, you just, there's no amount of training in the world that can prepare you for facing an unseen force like that. And then that's what always fascinates me about this. When I start to, I don't know, find myself a little weary of the paranormal, and then you hear about police officers and doctors and people like that that are confronting these aspects of our world, and it kind of shakes you back into a, there's something here. There's a lot more here than I'm ready to always admit to, or that I, you know, was ready to admit to. So it's, I don't know. That's, I find that aspect of this really exciting. Does that, you know, fire you up when you go into, you know, talk to these officers of the law and, you know, they start peeling back these stories to you? Do you ever look at me, come on, are you just jerking me around, or, you know?
You know, the level of discomfort in conveying the story to me, kind of gives it validity a lot of times. And I've learned to read people over the years, you know, working in retail and dealing with, you know, hundreds of employees at a time. And, you know, I've learned doing interviews, you know, I'm 49 years old, so I've been doing it since I was 16 years old. So I've learned to read people pretty well. And I can tell when someone's, you know, embellishing or somebody's just giving me a story, but I can certainly understand when someone is not comfortable telling me, you know, for whatever reason that they're coming at me. But it's, they want to know because they feel it's, they want to convey the story because it's therapeutic. Finally, somebody's asking me for real if I saw a ghost, because I have, and I've been dying to tell somebody, but my poker buddies don't ask me. You know, nobody at the gym asked me.
Right.
You know, so it's like, you know, it's like I'm dying to do this, and this guy's standing in front of me, and I'm like, so it's almost like a release. But they've never been asked the question. So they're sort of like, oh my, I've got this image in my head, and now it's, you know, I've got to somehow put it into words. So you got to give them time, and you can. I don't want to lead them. I never want to do that because I've had my experiences, and it's easy to say after a few words, "Oh, then this happened," or "It was this," and you can't do that because every situation is different. Like I said, I've been lucky. I've never been, you know, harmed or attacked. I mean, I've had some weird things happen and, you know, some uncomfortable things, but certainly never been tossed around a room or anything like that. So I want to hear in their words, you know, and usually, you know, they'll use terminology that's comfortable. I had one guy who was a football player, and then became a police officer, and everything was a football analogy. So I was like, okay, we'll go with that, you know. But it was hilarious, you know, to hear him convey this story to me. But yeah, so it's interesting. But I, like I said, I let them say in their words, and a lot of times they'll tell me real quick, they get it out. And then they'll go, oh, and this happened. Oh, and you know, I saw red eyes, or, you know, that was a common theme. They saw red eyes in the dark. And I heard that more than once, and it was often in either a drug house or a house in which drugs
How would they deal with that then? Would it be something that they would go to confront? I mean, again, you're there to serve and protect. If you think something's going on and you see what could be a form and it appears to have red eyes in a room, you know, do you draw on it? Do you, what was the action that most of them would take that they, when they would tell you they'd encountered these things?
So they would flip on the light and there would be nothing there. They would shine their flashlight and it would be gone. And they would assume it was a trick of the eyes because that's what we do. If we see something and then it's gone, of course, you know, the secondary sense to seeing something is touching because then it makes it real. So we see something we like, and what do we want to do? We want to touch it. And if we can't, then we say, oh, sorry, it's not real because we no longer see it and I didn't get to touch it. And that's how we're wired.
Right. The book is out and available. We've got a link. If you go to darknessradio.com and click on our Killer Deals link, you'll find it right there. Ghost Crimes, based on actual paranormal cases. Gare Allen, our guest. When we return, we'll delve into some of the cases that he highlights in the book. And I'm curious, Gare, I'll throw this to you and we'll get your answer when we come back. A recent thing that's been happening for me is that I've begun hearing from fire officials regarding some of the supernatural claims. And one of the stories I heard, really good guy. I have full faith in him. I don't think he was jerking my chain because he knew who I was. He said it, and he had this glossed over look in his eye. We'll talk about that when we return, but I'd love to know if you've talked to EMTs, firemen, and other firefighters, I should say, or others that have also conveyed these kind of stories. We'll do that when we return to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the show. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Gare Allen has a new book out, Ghost Crimes, based on actual paranormal cases that he has collected from law enforcement officials and has woven a narrative with these different stories. So it's a novelization of real life encounters with law enforcement and the paranormal. I was curious, you know, Gare, I had an interesting deal. My oldest son is a firefighter for the city of Minneapolis. So I've mentioned that on air, and I've had the chance to travel, and I get a lot of emails and things, and I started hearing from firefighters, you know, that were like, oh, hey, you know, we've had these experiences, and we've talked to EMTs. But I'll tell you, one of the fire guys that I spoke to out of Chicago had a really weird story, and I think it was about 2 years ago he shared with me that he was called in. They were called into a fire that they put out. They were trying to get some information from the family on how the family began, and it was a Hispanic family. And the grandmother kept referring to, I think, the Diablo or whatever, the devil. And, you know, they're like, yeah, yeah, okay, but, you know, what's going on with this? And the father, in very broken English, told them they don't know. Fires just keep happening, and they're trying to stay on top of them. And he said you could see scorch marks in different places around the house. So he assumed they had a bunch of kids that they, somebody's playing with matches, somebody maybe even drug paraphernalia, things that have gone wrong. And as he was talking to this guy, the guy yells and points, and the end table by them begins smoldering and bursts into flames. So this firefighter, he's like, what the hell? What the hell? Well, you know, linseed oil, if you rub things down with linseed oil, it can spontaneously combust. So he starts questioning, are there any chemicals? Are there cleaning solutions? What did they use? Nothing. As they're talking, they put this thing out. They get it under wraps. A few feet away, something else starts on fire. He said, Dave, it was literally like somebody was just tossing matches at random spots and they would just ignite. And he said, I've watched a lot of fires and it takes a few seconds for a fire to go. And in these cases, and I think he said he saw three, maybe it was even four spontaneous bursts of fire that would just pop up in different parts of this person's house. He said, I've never seen anything like it. They weren't, you know, you normally you'd start looking at maybe there's some bad wiring and it's shorting out all throughout the house, which is causing some. He said these were in rent, like one is a magazine rack, the other is an end table. These things aren't even plugged in. There's nothing around them and they're smoldering and boom, they're in flames. And I thought, wow, that's kind of fascinating. And then I've heard from firefighters that have told me that when they were trying to help somebody out of the car, you know, in a horrible car wreck, they were being prompted what to do about the kid in the back seat, you know, about the loved one over in the passenger side. He needs help bad. And they'd pry the passenger out, and then by the time they'd get to the driver, they'd find out the driver had died on impact. But they were being directed from inside the vehicle. Somebody was telling them, no, my passenger's hurt. He needs out right now. Get him out. So they'd go over to that side and literally find out later the driver had been dead for a while. We covered a story, and we even talked to the officers on hand from a few years back. A car had flipped and had gone into the water, and they actually caught it on video, one of their chest cameras. As they're approaching, they can hear a woman yelling for help. And they get there, and she's saying, like, my baby, they're like, we're going to get him out. They get the baby out, and the baby, they rush him up the hill to save him. By the time they get to the woman, she had been dead for, I think, hours. She had drowned. But they have the audio from their chest camera. And you can Google that, folks. You'll find it. Now, I know we did an episode on it. Maybe Tim will play that in an upcoming replay of the show at some point. But, boy, that's powerful. And, you know, that just knocks you down when you've got these kind of guys. They're experiencing this. We had an EMT who told us, you know, I've heard a lot of the great stories where it's, you know, they're performing CPR and then somebody who's flatlined and dead, and then they bring them back and the person can tell them all about what happened as though they were outside the body. But the guy we were talking to was when we were at the All Ireland Paracon, and I've got the audio up. We should try to play it at some point. But he tells his story where he's working on a guy and looks up and the guy is sitting across from him and kind of shaking his head, and he lost the guy. He was seeing the guy outside of his own body while he was trying to perform CPR on him.
Whoa.
Yeah, right? So that was kind of a flip on the old story. Just great stuff. And you know what? I think what we'll do is that story is interesting, and it's done more in an interview form, but maybe we'll play that on Friday for this week's Theater of the Mind so you can actually hear this guy tell the story. It's pretty remarkable, to say the least. But, yeah, that's crazy. Have you heard from other safety people like that, from firefighters, EMTs, anybody like that, technicians that have gone out on these calls and experienced the paranormal?
I did. I spoke with, I got one story from a fireman and I got one story from an EMT. And with the EMT, they had received a call, and it was a woman saying that a woman had had a heart attack, and she was upstairs in her home, and gave the address and hung up. And so they were dispatched, and they showed up to the house, and they knocked, and no one answered. So they tried the door, and the door opened. And as they opened the door, there was a woman standing there in a yellow bathrobe, and she had long blonde hair, and she wasn't really that old. They said they like maybe early 40s, and they said, you know, we're responding to a call, and she just pointed upstairs, and that's what they were told on the call, that the woman was upstairs. So they rushed upstairs, and they get up there, and that same woman in that bathrobe is laying on the floor. And so they start to perform CPR. Unfortunately, they weren't able to resuscitate her. And they go back downstairs. The woman's nowhere to be found, but it was the same woman that they had seen upstairs. And they checked the call later, and the call came from within the house, not to sound like a bad movie, but it came from within the house. And there was like, whoa, you know, so, it, you know, there was really nothing else to say other than they responded. The woman could not be resuscitated, and that was what was put in the report. Somebody called it in. They don't know who. Nobody let them in. They did let themselves in. So it was hard to say anything about this woman that pointed upstairs.
Right.
The fireman I talked to responded to a call, and the house was ablaze, and it was a small one-story house. But it was mostly on one side of the house, but there was a child on the left-hand side of the house. So he got in, he went to the left, and the fire had started to come over to that side of the house. And he went into the room, and he was adamant about this. He said, I am not lying to you. I'm telling you exactly what I saw. He goes, there was fire on the walls. He goes, and there was fire on the carpet, except for a perfect circle on the floor where the child was sitting with their knees to their face and just surrounded by fire, but there was no fire in a perfect circle in the middle of the room. And
as if something was surrounding and saving this child.
Exactly. So wow. He grabs the girl, he runs out, and he takes her over, and they start checking her out. You know, smoke inhalation, there's some other issues. And he said something to the effect of, you had somebody watching over you. And she says, my Nana.
Oh.
And yeah, and it just kind of, you know, you kind of get a visual when you hear that. You know, we've seen a lot of movies where loved ones come in and help us or whatever. And he just looked at her and he said, you know, I don't know how to explain my feeling at that moment other than it just resonated with him. It just felt real that he had seen that she was protected. He said, if you could make a perfect circle, that's what it was. He's like, there's no way that it could burn around a circle in the carpet. There's no way. And he's like describing it over and over to me because he couldn't make sense of it. How does the physics didn't work? And when the physics are out of line, welcome to the paranormal. You're
exactly
on that.
Exactly. All right. I want to get back into some of these stories in your book here and some of the tales that you were able to collect and weave through this narrative. What are some of the weirdest and most obscure stories that you found that, boy, this is something it hits you right between the eyes and you know this fits in a book?
You know, it's interesting because the stories span about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 years ago, you know, the chest cameras and the dash cams and all those things in our cell phones, you know, weren't so readily available. Now you can't blink without somebody capturing it on video. So but I did have one story where somebody owned a small furniture store, and the store was closed, and the owner had seen a man walking through her store. So she went and tried to find him, and she saw him walk through a wall and disappear. So a few minutes later, she finds him laying flat on the ground. He's in a black long coat with a fedora hat, and he's got his arms crossed across his chest as if he's laying in a coffin. And she becomes hysterical, and she pulls out her compact, and she holds the mirror under his nose and realizes he's not breathing. And so she calls in calls the police. So they come out, and by the time they get there, the man has disappeared. So she happened to have surveillance video. So they pull the video, and they're looking at the video, and they see everything that she described, everything that, you know, the man's walking to the wall. She finds him, you know, laying on the floor, and then they see him get up from the floor as she walked away and walk through the wall into the neighboring business.
No way.
Yeah, it's on video. So they're standing there dumbfounded. Just then, they see a woman walk through, and she's like, this is crazy. My store's been locked. I've been closed. I'm doing inventory. I'm not open today. And a woman walks in, and this woman is wearing like a 1960s dress a la Jackie Onassis, and she's very, you know, affluent looking, and she walks straight through the same wall. So the police are like, okay, we need to go next door and check this out. What's next door? And she's like, well, it's a donation depot that people drop off donations. So they go next door, and they start talking to the owner, and the owner's very busy, and she's like, do you mind if I work while we talk? And they're like, no problem. So she's going through some boxes that were just delivered that morning. And as they're talking, she pulls out this long black coat and then a fedora hat. And they're like, what's the story with this box? And they're like, well, this gentleman was just put to rest today. Their family brought this after the funeral to donate. And they look at the black jacket, and there's little white hairs. And they had noted that the man had very white hair beneath his fedora hat. And so they look to the other box, and they said, what's the story with this box? And she starts pulling out all these old 1960s clothing. And she's like, well, this woman's sister died years ago. And she had held on to her sister's belongings because she was so distraught over her passing. So she kept them in storage for decades. And she just donated them finally this morning, and or that morning. And so that was what they pulled out of the box, was exactly what they saw the woman in the video wearing, who had disappeared through the wall back into that donation depot.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did the woman that owned the donation depot, did she start opening up about having strange encounters there? I mean, that's weird that two back to back came walking through the wall right where their clothes were.
She said she had experienced some electrical issues and some minor things like that, but she, other than that, no, but, you know, they went back and they spoke with the woman who owned the furniture store, and she was actually very open to the experience, and that she said that she understood, you know, that people are still attached to their personal belongings, and for whatever reason, this man was still attached to that, his favorite coat or his favorite fedora hat, but when he was laying on the floor, he was laying like he would have been in his coffin, which he was in just a few hours prior that morning.
Unreal.
Yeah, and then of course the same thing with the woman that, you know, she was, you know, they, she had finally, the sister was holding on to her clothing because she couldn't bear to give it up. I think if she gave up the clothing, it meant that her sister was really passed, and she had passed very young. They were obviously very close. So when she finally was able to get rid of the clothing, that was her releasing her. And you read a lot of stories about, you know, loved ones hanging around, and you wonder sometimes if they're being held back, or they're staying, you know, because they're so attached, or their loved ones are distraught. And, you know, there's a thought process out there that we hold them back from moving on because they feel a commitment to us, you know, to stay with us and protect us, or because we're grieving, you know, so heavily that they want to stay and be near us. So, you know, the clothing is interesting. You know, did she want to pass wearing that favorite outfit? She couldn't pass because, you know, it was still in the possession of her sister, and it raises a lot of interesting questions.
Yeah, it does. And how did the police, I mean, there's video footage of this. There's corroborative evidence. I mean, first of all, that in itself, why has that not been released to the world?
Right. So when they went back and they explained the situation, they're like, okay, well, we're going to report that there, I think it was a 1054 was the code, which was the report of a possible, you know, deceased person. I forget, you know, exactly, but it was something along that line. And they said, well, we're going to report that there was no deceased person. And the owner of this furniture store was like, I'm totally fine with that because there wasn't, and I'm going to look like a fool. And they're like, okay, so what do you want us to report? And she was like, I don't care what you report. All I know is, you know, my bad, you know, my mistake, you know, it didn't happen. But if you want to challenge me, you know, I have video. And this was probably early 90s, I guess. And they did not ask for the video footage. They did not report it. They said it was a mistake and reported it as such and just moved on. And I said, so someone's supposedly dead, and you go, and there's not somebody dead. And there's no, like, well, what did you find? There's no, and they're like, no, because people report crazy things all the time. Because there's so many ridiculous reports out there, that this stuff will get buried. This stuff will get overlooked. People call in the most ridiculous things, and I mean, they're actually training 911 operators to sift through these things and not, you know, it used to be called 911, everything got sent through right away, and it's not like that anymore. There's so many false claims. There's so many bogus things that are done, or people that are, you know, high or drunk or whatever, and so they have to be careful because they can't send all these folks out, you know, these responders out to these, you know, claims that don't exist, and then have nobody for the real ones. So, yeah, it was very interesting. So that was never, they didn't ask for the video; they kind of just let it go. It was done with. Yeah,
that'll impact you, boy. That'll change your whole philosophy on life and the afterlife when you have an experience or two like that.
So what's interesting is, and I kept very true to the story in my book, in that one of the detectives was very much not a believer. Well, he was a believer because he was forced to be a believer. He kept having experiences, and he didn't want to have the experiences. He was a reluctant believer, I guess is the best way to put that. And his, you know, a partner or the guy he would often pair up with, they were sort of unofficial partners, but they did a lot of cases together. And he was like, you know, you're getting a bad reputation. You need to be careful what you repeat. And he's like, look, man, I don't care what people think. I'm telling you what I saw. It is what it is. And he had his own trauma in life, so he was a pretty distraught guy. And so this case sort of, the other partner was like, oh, man, this is real. And he was like, welcome to my world. And it was a turning point for them in their professional relationship.
Yeah, that's boy, that's a hell of a tale. That's a great one. And, you know, I'm just curious, too, when you're talking to people to gather stories like this, do they then open up and go, you know, if you think that's a good story, you should talk to my buddy Officer Llewellyn over at Cook County and point you to a different cop and a story? Or are they pretty tight-lipped to kind of that thin blue line of not tattling on each other's weirdness, too?
No, but what they will do is they go, and when I was 8 years old,
right.
And I'll get the childhood ghost, and I'm like, okay, that's pretty cool. But I'd rather hear it from an adult's mind and perspective, so unless it's connected somehow, you know. But no, they keep to their own. And like I said, you could see as I talked, I had to really bring them out of their shell, and, you know, and okay. And once they realized that I didn't find them crazy for what they were saying, and they were in a safe space, so to speak, you know,
right.
I was like, okay, they're really telling me. They're like, and then this happened, and then this happened. And what does it mean when you see a, you know, okay, hold on now, I'm not a counselor.
Right.
I'm just making dictation here. But the floodgates come down.
Just lay down on the couch and let's talk, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Do they ever report to you at all about, you know, I mean, we talked about the ghost aspect and some of the paranormal. What about alien encounters or even cryptids? Have there been any that have come to you when they get a call on something like that unexplained and they go out there and actually encounter something?
So there was one time when they responded, there were two individuals, and I don't even want to say their gender because it was such, they were so adamant that I don't use it, but they wanted to share it with me. And I thought that was super cool. And I think it's therapeutic when they say, oh, thank God, someone wants to hear this. And you're going to take me seriously when I say this, right? And I'm like, absolutely. But you're not going to tell anyone. No, I'm not going to tell anyone. And I want to honor that. I really want to honor that. So I have to be, like you said, you have to be super careful what you repeat. But they responded to an incident where, and it's heartbreaking that this poor child went through this, but I think the child was probably 14 or 15, and he had literally dug at his neck to get what he thought was an alien implant out of his neck, and he had clawed a hole into the back of his neck and convinced there was something in there, just convinced. And there was a piece of metal on the floor where he had done it. And then he was bleeding. But what had happened was there was a friend staying over for the night, and the parents had thought that they had gotten in a fight and had called the police because he had attacked their son. And of course, EMTs came out because there was a big gash in his neck and it was bleeding and it had stitches. But there was a piece of metal, and the best way they said they could describe it was the, you know how, what do they call it? Girls wear those, is it a barrette, I guess, and the back of it is that thin kind of arched piece.
Right, the clasp, sure.
Oh, there you go. And so it was that, and that was on the floor. And the that piece they determined had no blood on it. It had nothing to do with what had happened. But there was, the mother didn't wear barrettes. There were no sisters. There were no other girls in the house. So no one had ever seen it. Any idea how it got there? But the kid swore up and down. He's like, that's what I took out of my neck. But there was no blood on it. And so they were torn because this. I mean, this kid believed, and this kid was not. This was a good kid, you know, kind of just an average kid, nothing crazy about him, good grades, you know, no drugs, no nothing. He was just kind of an average kid. And but he swore up and down that it happened. Now, talking to the neighbors, they said that they weren't sure about what the family was like, but they were annoyed that they always had bright lights behind their house. And the kid had described that the alien ship would go behind their house and shine into the windows, and that's how he would be taken. And he described several abductions. And the neighbors would complain about the bright lights, and they thought they were just turning on all their lights in the middle of the night.
Ooh.
Yeah, so they kind of kept going back to the neighbors, and they go back to the family and kind of get information. But nothing was ever videoed or anything like that. So I've never personally had really any experience with anything that I would consider UFO or alien or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of glad.
Yeah.
I'd rather deal with the paranormal world. And then who's to say, I mean, for all we know, aliens are using that astral or paranormal world to travel and do their things, for all we know. Sometimes these ghosts may be aliens. I mean, how do we know? You know, I see the paranormal world as almost like, let's pretend you've never been to Earth and you were dropped down on Earth. And you saw people, and you saw animals, and you saw all these different... You have no idea what any of these creatures are about, what their motivations are, what they're capable of, what their intentions are. You know, so I imagine the paranormal world is filled with beings that we have no idea what they're about and what their drive is,
right,
their instinct, their ambition. So, you know, we get little glimpses, and I think half the time we just hope they're loved ones, but... Who knows, you know, what's really, you know, contacting us or, you know, crossing over the veil, so to speak.
Now, in the book, Ghost Crimes, it chronicles the crime investigation cases of Detective Burke in this novelization. Residing in Central Florida, Burke is driven by his sworn duty to protect the innocent, especially children. And a possession case in June of 1996 finds him face-to-face with the paranormal world. What can you give us a little background on the story that you based this possession case on, and what that was like, what the officers referred to, and how did that go down?
So that is actually the case from my childhood.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yes, that is actually based on that. And I got several cases from one individual detective who I based Burke on.
Mm-hmm.
And I allowed Burke, so to speak, to read it, and he approved, even though the similarities are pretty scary. I was surprised he was okay with it, but he was, because he said, no one will know it's me. And I'm like, okay, because I mean, the physicality, I mean, everything that happened, I mean, I tried to keep it absolutely, you know, on key. And he said, I want the story told, I just don't want it linked to me, nothing in here will link it to me. But to me, it's like, oh my God, if anybody knew him, I don't think you would know it was him, but he was very confident that, and comfortable that that I didn't, you know, out him, so to speak, you know, was the one who went through that. But he went through so much, and he was devoted to saving children and protecting children for personal reasons that he wouldn't go into. I had assumed there was a loss at some point, and so that's why I put that, especially children. That is his driving force. He loved that I put that into the character. So in a way, I was able to honor him for what he went through. And it didn't matter that nobody will know that that was him. The fact, again, these guys and then these women, that when their story is told, when they're able to tell it or it's told out there, it's therapeutic. It's like, okay, good. You know, it's out there now and people are accepting it. They're saying, yeah, I believe that can happen. And that is huge. That just takes such a weight off their shoulder. You know, and so in a small way, I feel good that I was able to do that for him.
Now, I know that, you know, I've talked to a lot of officers who've had a call or an example, but none that seem to have a recurring dalliance in the paranormal. Do you find, have you run into many police officers who had multiple accounts with dealing with the supernatural? Did they become unwittingly the Fox Mulder of their department, and when something was going down, they would call on that officer to be kind of the one to go out and investigate it?
They did, and Burke was one of them, and it wasn't too terrible. It wasn't like, you know, he didn't get a bad reputation, but there were certainly some, you know, elbows in the ribs. Hey, I think I saw a ghost. Come check it out. You know, kind of thing. You know, hey, that's pretty funny. But again, he was a detective in the 80s through the 90s until he retired. So it was a different time back then. It wasn't as widely accepted. And, you know, you get a lot of jeers and things like that. But he was definitely, he did not like what he saw. And he struggled to make sense of it, to blame a human. You know, to blame, and there's a line in the book where, you know, Garrison is telling Burke, he's like, you know, you're seeing ghosts. He's like, these aren't ghost crimes. People commit crimes. And he's trying to convince him that there's a logical explanation. You need to focus on the physical. You need to be more analytical. And he's like, look, I don't want to believe these things are happening, but I can't deny these things that I've seen. I just can't. And he struggles. There's that huge dichotomy of believing that they don't exist, yet seeing that they exist. And that's hard. It's so hard for him to do his job, and because he wants to do what's best for the victims. So it was a huge struggle. He drank heavily. He wasn't in the greatest physical shape to begin with, so he struggled on a physical level, and it was very tough on him, and he was able to kind of turn it around and make sense of it. And a lot of it was because of, you know, the paranormal coming into our culture is widely accepted. And, yeah, you know, I don't know. You probably know the statistic better than I do. What is it? Probably 75% of people believe that there are ghosts or have seen a ghost. I mean, it's huge.
I don't know. It changes, it seems, yearly. Sometimes it's 45 to 55%. Sometimes it's 60 to 70. It just kind of vacillates, I think, on the year and who they actually talk to. If they're taking that poll outside of a paranormal conference or a horror movie, they may get a much higher skew.
Sure. I think people are more like, you know, yeah, there's something beyond the physical of, you know, if Trump can be president, why can't there be ghosts, right?
Right. No, I just saw a great cartoon today. This guy sits up in bed, and he's like, damn. And the girlfriend's like, what's wrong? And he goes, I just realized there are no ghosts. There is no Area 51. There are no aliens or Bigfoot. And she goes, what are you talking about? And he said, Trump is president. If any of that was true, he couldn't shut his big fat mouth about it.
You know what's funny is I'll admit, I totally thought, okay, Trump's president. You know, he ran to the Secret Service and said, tell me, what's the deal with aliens? What deal have we made? What's going to happen? You know, what is going on? And you're right. How could he possibly not tweet that? He would have.
Oh, yeah, you know it. Yeah, I'm not saying anything, but we're not alone. Have a good day.
Yeah, right?
That would be the kind of weird messaging we'd get. Well, man, it's always a great time talking with you, Gare, and time slips away from us quickly when we do the shows like this. Please keep us in mind as you continue on. And for our listeners, if you are law enforcement, medical personnel, firefighter, and you've had an experience with the paranormal, I'd love to feature your story on a Parashare episode, or perhaps even feature it on a Theater of the Mind episode. So just contact me, dave@darknessradio.com. Tell me your story in the clearest, nicest narrative that you can, and you may hear it featured here on an upcoming episode. But I'm fascinated by this. I know Gare's fascinated. The readers of his books and the listeners of the show are fascinated by it. So if you are one of those people or you know someone who is, ask them to write it down and share it with us. I would love to hear more of these encounters. Are you out still collecting more stories regarding the supernatural and the paranormal, Gare?
You know, I've switched gears a little bit. I wrote 13 books, and I wrote the stories that I had always intended to write. And I got to a point where I'm actually been cast in an independent film that's going to be filmed here in Tampa in February, and I always wanted to make my short stories into screenplays. So I'm actually writing a screenplay now for one of my short stories, and then I'll be continuing on with my metaphysical short stories and making those screenplays. So I'm switching gears right now from books to screenplays, and hopefully I'll see those realized, you know, out on the screen. So that's my focus right now, but Ghost Crimes is done very well in the short time that it's been out, so I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I hadn't thought about Ghost Crimes 2. I joked that it would say 33% more ghosts.
But only half the calories.
Only half the calories, yeah. So gluten-free, non-GMO ghosts. So yeah, I'll be focused on that probably sooner than later. But I do want to get my screenplays out and see if I can get some of these books into movies and on the screen. I mean, that'd be great to see.
That would be. And just remember your pals at Darkness Radio and Beyond the Darkness when you hit it big time.
Absolutely will.
I expect to still hear from you and get some exclusive interviews off of you on the deal. Have you got a good creepy story to leave us with? One more paranormal encounter?
Okay, so I'll give you the very first one I had when I was 12 years old. I was lying in my bed, and my bedroom was at the top of the stairs in the house that I lived in, and the family dog was at the foot of my bed, and it was perfectly quiet, perfectly still, and my bed simply rose up a few inches, wobbled a little bit, and fell back down, and my dog jumped up and reacted. My limbs moved, which told me that something had physically happened. And at the same time, my older brother had been walking up the stairs to go down to his bedroom, and he peers in the door and he goes, "What was that noise?" And I just looked at him because I must have been white as a sheet because my bed had literally just elevated and dropped. And he just kind of, you know, gave me a scoff like, you know, stupid little brother, and just wandered off down to his room. That is the first time anything paranormal had happened to me, and it scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah, wow, what a way to start off a lifetime. Hey, Gary, it's a pleasure. We have a link up to your book if people just go visit darknessradio.com and click on the Killer Deals link. You'll be able to find the book Ghost Crimes, based on actual paranormal cases by Gare Allen. We'll have that up and available for you. I do want to remind listeners, too, to check out that page, because we update it regularly with all of the different authors' books that you hear on our show and on True Crime Tuesday. Plus, there are some really cool paranormal equipment, swag, and more on that page. And if you're going to purchase anything through Amazon, use our link, because a very small portion of every sale goes to help us with our administrative costs. So please remember to use that and link to it, bookmark it, and make sure that you keep it. So our Killer Deals link is always your go-to to access Amazon.com. We don't get any of your private information. Like I said, it's just a small percentage of all sales go to help out our show. So it's an affiliate program that we appreciate working with. Thank you all for being there. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And until then, if you hear that strange walking in your attic, something knocking in your basement, you better think twice before you call 911. This is Beyond the Darkness.